I'm Hanny Fakuri. I'm a staff attorney with the Electronic Frontier Foundation in San Francisco. And what I want to talk to you folks today in about 10 minutes, or hopefully less than 10 minutes, because we've got a lot of people to get to, is my rights in your hands. And when I was approached about talking to you folks today, the situation that kind of came to my mind is basically a fundamental conflict between the explosion in technology and the data it generates and who really controls how that data is turned over or released. And what I'm really talking about is the phenomenon where, as we as individual users put so much of our lives into an electronic or digital form and then give it to somebody else and entrust, hopefully, that that person has our best interests at mind and keeps that information private from the hands of either the government or other people who want to get that information. And the problem is courts are struggling to deal with this concept. And they're struggling to deal with this concept because the two principal, I guess, legal frameworks that we have when we're discussing data stored on the internet or online did not take into account or could not foresee the realities of technology in the 21st century. There are really, when we talk about your legal rights on the internet, there are really two things we're talking about. The first is the Stored Communications Act. This is a large, confusing framework of law, federal law, that governs basically what providers that store data. So we're talking about companies, generally speaking, but not necessarily, not always, when they can disclose that information to the government, when they cannot disclose that information to the government, and how the government can get their hands on information that it wants. And then the second kind of legal framework we're talking about is obviously the Fourth Amendment. The Fourth Amendment to the Constitution obviously says that you have a right to be free from unreasonable government search and seizure. Boiled down, what that means is that, generally speaking, you have a reasonable expectation of privacy. And when you have a reasonable expectation of privacy in something, the government has to get a search warrant to get its hands on that information. Now, there's a lot of nuance to that, and I'm going to talk about some of those nuances in a minute. Let's start with the Stored Communications Act. The big problem with the Stored Communications Act is that it's now celebrating it's over 25 years old. It was written in 1986. At a time when the internet and the World Wide Web were not things that people accessed on their computers, accessed on their cell phones, were plugged into constantly. And as a result, it's written in an archaic way that does not reflect the reality of technology today. So for example, under the Stored Communications Act, email is entitled to certain protection, specifically a search warrant requirement, if it has been stored on a provider like Gmail or whatever for less than 180 days. But if email has been stored on if you've got mail in your inbox, for example, that's older than 180 days, the government doesn't necessarily need a search warrant to get it. They can get it with a subpoena. Why was 180 days drawn as this arbitrary benchmark that differentiates between whether the police have to go get a search warrant that's based on probable cause and signed by a judge versus a subpoena that is not based on probable cause? Well, obviously in 1986, when the internet was, when this law was enacted, email, people didn't use Gmail as a way to store 10 years worth of correspondence, right? It was not perceived in the way it is perceived today. And again, the Stored Communications Act fails to take these types of changes into account, and it hasn't been updated. With respect to the Fourth Amendment, the problem in the Fourth Amendment, at least in terms of this type of data that's being held by so many other people, is that there is a principle of Fourth Amendment law known as the third-party doctrine. What this doctrine says is that you lose your right to privacy in information you turn over to a third party. And the two cases that dealt with this principle, or at least highlighted it, came from the 1970s. The first case involved basically bank records. A person goes to a bank, deposits certain amounts of money, withdraws certain amount of money. The government wants to subpoena those records, and the Supreme Court held that that person had no right of privacy in those records and in those transactions because he'd already knowingly turned them over to the government. The second case involved a person who dials a phone. whether he has a right of privacy in the phone numbers that he dials on his telephone. And the Supreme Court again said, no, you don't have a right of privacy in that, because in order for the phone company to route your phone to the correct place, you have to turn over the fact, you know, the phone number you want dialed. And out of those two old cases that don't, again, reflect the realities of technology today, this doctrine, this third-party doctrine, has come into existence. And it has played a very profound impact on how cases involving technology and civil liberties have really evolved. So, and I want to talk about two specific cases that deal with some of these problems in some more detail. So the first, and again, it's dependent, you know, your legal rights on the internet are dependent on who has access to that data and when they obtain that access. So the two cases I want to talk about, the first is a recent case from California called Juror Number 1 versus the County of Sacramento. And Orrin Kerr, on his blog on the Avala conspiracy, has written about this case, and it's a really fascinating read, and I'd encourage you all to read it. But basically, in a nutshell, what happened here was this is a case that arose out of a allegation of juror misconduct. Basically, this guy was on trial in a criminal case for 2 months. And after the trial was concluded and the defendant had been found guilty, it came to light that at some points during his trial, he was posting updates on his Facebook page saying, I'm in day 25 of trial and it's boring. Today, we listened to 2 hours worth of Metro PCS phone records. This is the worst day of my life. Something to that effect. So the defendant who lost at trial wanted to subpoena the Facebook records to see what he had said on his Facebook page, because this would potentially be juror misconduct and could potentially be grounds for him having a new trial. And what the juror did, what the defendant did rather, was he subpoenaed both Facebook for this information and he subpoenaed the individual user himself also for this information. And both Facebook and the user filed motions to quash, or basically challenged whether the defendant was entitled to access these records. Now, what's crucial is that the records that the defendant sought to access were a number of months of this individual's Facebook activity. So it wasn't even narrowly focused on any updates that could potentially be related to this criminal case. It was any updates from X date to X date over a number of months. The trial judge, what he did was he found that the subpoena that was issued to the user was too broad, and he quashed it. And what he ordered, let me back up a second. He basically ruled that Facebook did not have to respond to the subpoena because under the Stored Communications Act, Facebook is not entitled to or not allowed to give this information over to a private litigant in a lawsuit unless a user consents to that release. So because the Stored Communications Act wouldn't let Facebook turn this information over to the defendant, what the judge decided to do was to tell the defendant, the juror in question, to sign a consent form consenting that Facebook turn the information over to the judge. Again, this is because the law did not anticipate this type of situation. So in order to make a workaround the barriers in the law, the judge basically said, you are going to have to consent to this. And that's because the Stored Communications Act didn't prohibit that. This went up on appeal, and the appellate court said there's no problem with this. The Stored Communications Act doesn't prohibit a person from consenting to, you know, this type of disclosure. And because this, you know, Facebook is not allowed under the Stored Communications Act to turn this information over to the defendant personally, this is kind of a way around the hole in the case in order to get at the truth of whether or not there's been juror misconduct. So obviously the problem here is pretty apparent. You know, you can't force someone to agree to do something, because then it's not actually legally valid binding consent. The second case, and this is more of the Fourth Amendment case, is People of New York versus Harris, and this is a case that received quite a bit of press. It's a case where Mr. Harris was arrested on the Brooklyn Bridge as part of an Occupy Wall Street protest in October of 2011. And basically, the New York City District Attorney's Office sent a subpoena to Twitter asking for all of Mr. Harris's tweets and any other information that Twitter had on Mr. Harris. Mr. Harris moved to quash the subpoena, saying it was broad and raising a number of constitutional challenges, including a Fourth Amendment challenge, that it was his, you know, private writings, including a First Amendment challenge. And what the judge ruled in denying this challenge to the subpoena was he found that because Harris had given this information over to Twitter, that the information, i.e., the tweets that he posted and other messages and other anything he did on Twitter and any information Twitter had on Mr. Harris belonged to Twitter. And because it belonged to Twitter, Harris had no legal standing or no ability to challenge this subpoena that was sent over to the to Twitter. So, you know, thankfully, Twitter stepped in and filed a motion to quash disputing this, and in interest of disclosure, EFF, along with the ACLU and Public Knowledge, filed an amicus brief in support of Twitter saying this is the right step. But this really, I think, kind of highlights the problem. The problem being that all the control of this data, of your data, of my data, is in the hands of electronic providers. And as these two cases demonstrate, the users, in a sense, kind of lose either way, because in the Twitter case, the court found that Harris didn't control his own information. He didn't control or have any access or power over his own tweets. And in this County of Sacramento case, well, if he does have access or control over this material, which is what exactly happened in the Facebook juror case, you are required to consent to the provider turning it over to the judge for a review of all of the material to decide what should be handed over to someone else. So the problem here, again, is that control is in the hands of the providers. And I'm going to briefly, just in like two words or three words, say what I think the solution is. And I think the other panelists are going to talk about some of these solutions. But obviously, in my mind, the solution is both a change to the legal structure and how we think of the way technology and the law interacts. And that requires both a revisitation of the third party doctrine, which the Supreme Court, at least Justice Sotomayor in her concurring opinion in the Jones GPS case, kind of signaled that it was time to reexamine this doctrine as it applied to technologies because of the ability of technology to gather and store and keep all this data, and the fact of the matter, which is that people are turning over this data over to third parties, as well as a need to update statutes like the Stored Communications Act to better reflect technology. And in terms of technological changes, I think what we need is that companies that are handling a lot of third parties' data, or I'm sorry, a lot of user data, companies like Twitter or Facebook, Google, whoever it may be, they both need to be transparent about what they're doing and what they keep, and they need to limit what they keep to the minimum necessary to provide services to their customers, because otherwise they end up with this treasure trove of data that is very easy for the government to get, unfortunately. And again, obviously what we want to see is other companies take the lead of, follow Twitter's lead in committing to their users and standing up for their users when they've received subpoenas that they perceive to be overly broad, or and to challenge and stand up to attempts to get this data, just like Twitter did in the Harris case. And this is my contact info if you have any questions. Otherwise, I'll leave it open to the other panelists. Thanks.
Great. Thank you. So framed somewhat, I really like the idea of my rights in your hands as sort of a nice way to frame this problem. So you have I'm just going to kill some time while Mike gets ready to go. So really phrased here as a Fourth Amendment problem, that it can also be presented as a First Amendment problem. And Mike, I know your work is a lot more sort of on the First Amendment, free press particularly, as well as free speech. But the idea is that the people who have that which you seek to protect don't necessarily have the incentive, or perhaps their incentives are very weak, to protect those rights, and as the law is understood today, don't really sometimes have the standing to challenge those rights, or also if they do try and challenge those rights under the doctrine as it's interpreted today under the Fourth Amendment, they will lose. So put a pin in the Fourth Amendment privacy, search and seizure sort of concerns with technology. We're going to turn and look at the First Amendment and some concerns as well.
It's perfectly timed.
Cool. All right.
Good. Go ahead, filling Mike. Time. Yeah. Great. Thanks very much. Thanks a lot, Andy. So I come to this conversation as a communication scholar, as somebody who's been studying the press and journalism and how they interact with new technologies. So I have less of sort of a formal legal background, but I come to it with this idea of what is the notion or what is the aim of a First Amendment, and how does the press embody or relate to that idea of a First Amendment? How does it matter? And what I want to do today, actually, is just walk you through a little bit of the guiding thinking that I have on this topic. And that's really centered around these three questions, and that is, what is a public right to hear as opposed to an individual right to speak? And I mean that purposefully to be a little bit provocative. What is a public right to hear? Why does it matter? And how do we see it being negotiated in different sorts of systems and different sorts of relationships? And what I want to argue is that today we see no shortage of opportunities, I think, for people to speak. There's a large number of systems and networks available for people to express themselves in different ways, whether it's through social media services or online micro-blogging services, or also a new collection of systems that are trying to organize speech into different ways and present to you a personalized or aggregated system. I'd argue that there's actually no shortage of ways to express yourself. But what I want to assert is that this idea of a public right to hear, and I'm defining it down there as this right to encounter ideas that self-interest, friends, markets, or algorithms alone aren't going to reveal. And my unit of analysis here isn't the individual. So it's not what you as a particular individual decide to do at a given moment, but it's actually a public. So it's a group of people who have a shared set of commonalities and shared set of interests, and who also share consequences. So publics are things that you cannot divorce yourself from. You cannot opt out of. There are resources that we all have to share. So that's my unit of analysis here, is how is a public able to hear information that individual self-interest, friends or relationships, markets or algorithms won't necessarily reveal for you? And it's an open question, because I think sometimes it happens and sometimes it doesn't. But if we want to think about how these issues of freedom of expression tie into some of the larger issues of civil rights and what it means to sort of have democratic self-expression, I think this notion of the listener or the hearer at a public level is really key. But when I come to this question, if that's the overarching aim, is how, where does a public right to hear live, in a sense, we need to go quite far back and say, well, that's something that in its ideal form, and I stress ideal form, not what actually happens a lot of time, in its ideal form, that's what the press has always claimed to be doing. It's claimed to have some notion of public interest at its core. It's often fallen down on the job. It's often fallen way short of actually presenting that ideal. But what I want to argue is that that's one of the reasons that we have these debates about what a press access mean, what is the relationship between the press and the Constitution, that's where the press's really core idea lives. And it's also the claim to fame. Whenever you hear press talking about, wow, that's an issue of press freedom or journalistic privilege, I'd argue that those are the only moments, that's what the press relies upon, its ability to enable a public right to hear. Those are the moments that the press is allowed to claim some kind of freedom or some kind of special status, or at least those are the moments that it really wants to push us to. And it relies on, I don't have time to get into in this talk, but this idea that constitutionally, and I'd argue normatively, the freedom to speak is not the same as the freedom of speech. So your individual right to express yourself is not necessarily the same thing as the need, the sort of democratic need for speech to be able to circulate and for us to encounter ideas that we wouldn't necessarily, again, hear through friends, markets, self-interest algorithms. So I come to this moment then where I say, well, how is that being worked out today? As sort of somebody who studies institutions and journalistic practices, if you buy my claim that there is this idea of a public right to hear that might be different, complementary too, I'm not arguing to replace, but might be different from your individual self-interest, where is that being worked out? And this is this word I've been using called newsware that Andy asked me to sort of bring up, so I'll expressly tell you about it. This idea of newsware, and it's an idea that comes from people who study science, technology, and society systems, who are essentially sociologists who study technological systems. They say that often technologies are the result of boundary work, Often technologies are these places where multiple actors come together. These are the people who design systems, these are the people who rely upon the systems, and often these are systems that are in the background or invisible or assumed or that we don't even encounter. So these are systems that we often only encounter when they break down. This is the definition of infrastructure. This is moments of system building that really matter who you are when you're looking at it, whether you notice the system even existing or not. So I define newsware here as this networked infrastructure of online news production. And these are what I argue are these shared, embedded, but often sort of largely invisible moments when the press and the public interact with each other. And operationally, those are technologies, those are algorithms, interfaces, different sort of flows of money around systems. And what I wanted to do is just to give you a flavor of what I mean by this is offer just a few examples. And I've studied a lot of these different kinds of systems through this framework, but one of them is this just notion of social aggregation authority. This is just probably a lot of people have seen this, this idea of trending articles in Facebook, but a lot of systems have this, where there's some sort of secret sauce here that's saying that this is a trending article for me based on a whole bunch of different kinds of actions that are built into the system that my friends are doing, that I've done in the past, rankings of the content provider. There's an authority, again, coming back to my public right to hear, that comes from this amalgamation of content and algorithm. Another one is this notion of reader authentication. So Huffington Post has this system, but a lot of systems do it, actually, called a badging system. So you can be a better or a worse commenter depending on how well you've behaved and performed in the past and how well some people have liked your comments or not liked your comments. So we're starting to see this differentiation of participation based that's sort of algorithmically baked into at least the Huffington Post system. Now, this is a little silly example, but I think especially in the context of drones and automated data gathering kind of makes sense. This is an example from the University of Tokyo, which is a robot that was designed by journalists and computer scientists at the University of Tokyo that surveys the room. One day it goes around the new room and makes a visual map of the room and makes sort of a sensory map of the room. It goes back in the next day and sees what's changed in the room and then automatically generates a news story, and it reads like a news story. I mean, there's a lot of systems that do this that can make systems that read quite journalistic, and it then builds a story of how the room changed in a particular model. Again, you know, it's a little bit of a silly example, but it's a moment when we sort of see system design and a notion of news meeting. And the three that the one that I've studied the most actually are news organizations' own application programming interfaces. So these are these basically, you know, in this room, you obviously know what that is, but these software toolkits where they're offering members of the public chances to actually create new software applications with the news organization's own data. But there's all these moments of sort of control and exertion of difference between what's a news organization, who's not a news actor. These are the moments when you have access to the data or you don't have access to the data, depending on what level of service you've subscribed to in the API. You can earn revenue or not earn revenue off the system. You have to through the terms of service, show ads or you don't have to show ads depending on the level of membership that you have in the API. This is a moment, I think it's a really interesting one, where news organizations are starting to sort of wade into system design territory, but that's a really awkward moment where they're struggling with what does it mean to retain editorial and journalistic control. And so I just land in here by saying that this is where speech freedom meets system design. This is this moment, I think, and it's sort of it's a moment that's existed in different periods of history, but the material differences of it today really matter. So I'll close with these are the three questions that sort of guide me in a lot of the work that I do, and I think it's one that might be of interest to talk about more in the Q&A. And it's this: where does a public right to hear exist in system design? If you sort of buy my original assertion, what does it mean when you're creating systems? How do we balance algorithms, self-interest, social relationships, and markets as we're designing these things? And kind of what's the model of public that guides your system design, and why? What assumptions are you making as you're building them? And these are some questions that I end with to get a little more concrete. What type of community support exists for your system builders? Who do you assume those system builders to be? Who's missing from your network of community and builders? Who would you like to have in there that you maybe don't? And how might you design for them? How's the quality of the expression or the quality of the speech judged in the systems that you're building? And what's missed in those metrics of quality? Who do you not get to hear from because they're baked in? One of the ones I talk about here. What levels of system description are available? APIs are sort of famous for what I've been calling sort of an ontological black box, or they only let you get so far down into the metadata of the system, and at a certain point, the news organizations say, no, that's for us to describe to you. We don't want to quite tell you exactly how that news story is described. We're going to just back away from that, and we'll give you one level of description. Internally, we have a different level of description. Important one is what revenue can participants earn? How does advertising revenue flow among these systems, and how do membership fees go? And then lastly, what learning models are embedded in the design? How do you take somebody from not knowing how to do one of these system building experiences and then bring them along to one where they might be able to embed their own models of public into it? So I'll stop there, and hopefully we'll get more into in Q&A, but those are my digits. Thanks.
Cool. Thank you so much, Mike. So now, while Wendy's setting up, I'll just quickly sort of recap some thoughts there. So I'm going to return back to your idea of my rights are in your hands as sort of the framing problem for the Fourth Amendment. In some ways, Mike, what you're bringing up is this idea of sort of my rights are being shaped by your hands, that the public, that part of the First Amendment is this idea of the right to hear, that we have this idea of democracy requires a sort of well-informed ingredient, and companies and technologists, whether or not they're intending it or not, are shaping what people understand, how they interact with the data that they receive, and that in turn is shaping their rights with respect to the data that they receive. So with that in mind, I'm gonna turn it over to Wendy Seltzer. Wendy wears many, many hats in the cyber law world, but I think today you're gonna be talking about Tor stuff, is that largely right, or are you gonna be?
Yes.
Yeah, great.
So I'm going to be talking about Tor and not about that tree there. So let's see if I can get this going properly on. Super. All right. So this is anonymity. And we sort of trace our discourse of anonymity in the United States back to the times of Publius and the federal farmer debating over the role of states' rights versus strong central government in the questions of drafting a U.S. Constitution. And they felt at the time that by giving themselves pseudonyms rather than names, only some of which historians have even managed to pin on their authors even to this day, that they were able to get the discussion going around issues rather than around personalities and around matters of substance rather than around the personal conflicts that might have been between them. So they wrote into the Bill of Rights that Congress shall make no law respecting or abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, and that has come down to us today. And of course, not everything was sweetness and light in the time of the framers. Along with anonymous speech, you had duels and leeches and writing by quill rather than by internet. So we take the good and the bad. But the courts continue to look at questions of speech and what rights are encompassed by that First Amendment. So this here, still pre-internet, although it looks as though it may have been created with a dot matrix printer. This is Margaret McIntyre's leaflet that she distributed at an Ohio school meeting, debating the question of whether school taxes should be raised. And she was against the raising of taxes and distributed these leaflets signed not by herself, but on behalf of concerned parents and taxpayers. And since she was there distributing them, it wasn't very hard when the Ohio Board of Elections wanted to enforce its law that all electioneering material had to be identified with its author's name, rather than just pseudonyms like concerned parents and taxpayers, and they chased her down to pay a fine for this forbidden anonymous speech. She took her case all the way up to the Supreme Court, and in 1995, the court said Ohio's law was unconstitutional. Like Publius and Federal Farmer, Margaret McIntyre had the right to speak anonymously on issues of political importance or otherwise, and couldn't be fined for circulating this pamphlet. Moving one step forward into the truly digital age, we now get courts confronting questions like that of XXLPPR on Yahoo stock boards, who's touting the or criticizing Dendrite International, arguing that their stock isn't worth the purchasing, against their defamation complaint, argues that he shouldn't even be forced to identify him or herself because Dendrite hasn't put forward the case that would be strong enough to survive motions for summary judgment, that they haven't shown that they'd have a case against him, and until showing that they have that case, shouldn't be able to unmask this hitherto anonymous speaker. In that case, the New Jersey courts held that, yes, the right to anonymous speech includes the right to speak online anonymously, and to do that until somebody has made a strong case, not just thrown a complaint into court saying, we don't like what this guy is saying, but has put forward all of the elements that would be required of a case for defamation or another case under the law. So they have to put forward the prima facie case for defamation, that he's making a false statement, that it's a false statement of fact, that it's harmful to reputation or harmful to the company. And until they show all of these things and that finding out his identity would actually help them to prosecute the case rather than just making somebody's life miserable, they can't get his identity. So there's the law, and most courts looking at these so-called John Doe cases have followed roughly this standard, saying even if the service provider has the identity of the person, they shouldn't turn it over to somebody suing until those basic elements of the case have been made out. This is still something that we're fighting on a state-by-state basis, and Citizen Media Law Project has lots and lots of different examples of these cases and places where people still need help fighting them. So that's the law, but then we have the technology, and I'm constitutionally obliged when talking about anonymity to show this cartoon, of course. This is the famous 1993 New Yorker cartoon, on the internet nobody knows you're a dog. And then to contrast that with more recent publicity of all of the ways that we not only know you're a dog, but all of the trees or websites you've visited and the IP address and DNA that you've given while doing that. Because you might have seen the Wall Street Journal's series on all of the website tracking, all of the ways that sites can identify their visitors. I see Peter Eckersley over there, who's partly responsible for EFF's Panopticlick project, showing the ways that how many visitors to this website can be uniquely identified just by features of your web browser, just by the screen resolution and fonts you have installed and other items that your web browser will report back to the web server without very much prompting, just some JavaScript and ordinary HTML and CSS. All of these things that help a web server that wants to identify you and to watch you as you return time after time. So even while the First Amendment guarantees you the right to anonymous speech, technology makes it remarkably easy for someone who wants to track. Just this past week, we saw the New York Times reporting on various leak investigations and prosecutors instructed to and empowered to investigate the source of various leaks of alleged national security information. When talking to journalists, we hear that the number of subpoenas to newsrooms have in fact been going down, even as the number of leak prosecutions is going up, because there are so many other ways for prosecutors and investigators to get information, because electronic communications leave so many digital trails that if you're not terrifically careful, you may think you're holding a private conversation, but in fact be leaving traces that are easy for investigators to find. And so if you're a whistleblower who thinks that you are confidentially communicating information, or someone engaged in political dialogue seeking to communicate without having your identity revealed, the law may be behind you, but the technology, at least by default, is not. And if we take a look at back to Lawrence Lessig's taxonomy of the different forces affecting us and our rights, even when the law gives us strength, if the market and the architecture and the norms aren't helping, it may be hard for us to defend our legal rights. But I think all is not lost, and so technologies can help us as well to reclaim those rights and to reclaim anonymity. And so I work with one such project, the Tor project, which offers software, both a downloadable client and server software that anyone can download and become part of the Tor network. And in essence, Tor works by routing your communications through a series of three hops, encrypting along the way. We call it onion routing because it first wraps up the communication in layers of encryption, and at each node, one of those layers is unwrapped as it's passed along to the next one. So it, as it goes through these hops, the first hop knows who you are, but not whom you're trying to communicate with. It only knows the next hop to send that packet along, where it's unwrapped another time and sent to the last hop, where they know what you're trying to reach, but not who you are when you came in. And so nobody in the network, this is privacy by design, anonymity by technical design, nobody in the network has enough information to identify both who is communicating and what they are trying to say. So this is a system designed to resist traffic analysis, to resist tracking online, and to give back the opportunities for anonymous speech and anonymous listening. You can browse a web page without being tracked back to your IP address or real personal information, and you can publish through Tor hidden services without being traced to your offline identity. The system, as well as offering anonymous browsing because of the encryption in it, has also proven useful for censorship circumvention and for users in countries who believe in censorship at the national level or firewalls that will block information, or where the regime will try to find people browsing or posting anti-regime material. So this particular graph shows Syrian users of Tor bridges. We don't know who these people are, but we can geolocate them to the country from which they're browsing. This is over the past year, and you can see a spike in usage around the middle of that period as conditions heated up and more people realized that they needed secure means to communicate, and found that the Tor network offered that greater security. Now, this here is a picture of the Myth TV music system that I have running my Tor node in my living room. You can run a Tor node, you can join the network and participate as a volunteer on just about any sort of hardware these days. So mine runs alongside my music system, and at one point earlier in the year, I noticed that listening to music remotely was starting to have a few skips in it, and came back afterwards to notice that some bridge usage had suddenly picked up among Syrian and Iranian users, and I was willing to give them that bandwidth over my own music listening. So I want to call your attention to a couple of other legal challenges that can then come back to threaten the technology of anonymity. So this was a provision in the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA, which, as all of you know, we killed through a tremendous groundswell of popular and commercial and media attention and action and calls to Congress. But before that blackout day and before the legislation was taken off the table, the bill had provisions that would have allowed the Attorney General to demand that domain names be blocked if they were used to access infringing or pirating material, and that moreover, that the Attorney General could take action against any entity who provided tools for circumvention or bypassing of the domain blocking provisions, something that we were very concerned could apply to general purpose technologies like Tor, which after all is promoted by the U.S. State Department for blocking of censorship outside the United States. Could that be targeted by the Attorney General under SOPA had it passed? Closer to home, in case you're looking for some place to take action, ICANN is in the next few weeks going to be meeting and talking about negotiations with the domain name registrars around registrar accreditation agreement. All sounds like a lot of legalese, but what they're planning to do is to, under the pressure from law enforcement, is to make it much more difficult to register a domain name, and in particular to insist that domain name registrants provide a full legal name, postal address, contact information, and be verified by resolution of an email address and response chain and an SMS or telephone verification, all to make sure that they have the identity of every person registering a domain name. Now, if you think that anonymity is important not just in speaking but in the registering of domain names in order to have a stable location for that speech, so you're not just depending on the goodwill of a blog host or other third-party server, then these developments should be of some concern too, and ICANN claims to be accepting comment on these provisions, and I will be trying to make some of those comments heard so that we can continue to have domain registrations with various bits of proxy information rather than the full address, telephone number, and identifying information published anytime we try to register domains. So with that, I will thank you and hope that we'll get some questions afterwards.
Great, thank you. So while Ryan is setting up, I'll sort of bring us to where we are here. So we've seen a lot of different dimensions here already. We've seen with Henny, with your work, talking about how the technology by its very nature can frustrate the rights that we have. Mike, we've talked about how the technology can shape the rights that you have inadvertently or intentionally. And now we have Wendy saying that the law, even when the law gives you rights, sometimes the technology can interfere with those rights. So you might be able to interfere with the technology, you might be able to interfere with the architecture that exists in order to further your own rights, But of course, then we have the governing authorities around the technology starting to push back, be that through SOPA or be that through ICANN's proposed rules about known anonymous registrars. So with that, I'm going to turn over to my friend and colleague, Ryan, to talk about Herdict.
Thank you, Andy. And thank you all for coming. My name is Ryan Budish, and I am a fellow at the Berkman Center. And I'm also a project director of something called the Herdict Project, which is something that we operate out of the Berkman Center. And I'll talk a little bit more about that in just a couple of minutes. What I really want to talk to you about today is about censorship and other forms of filtering on the internet and what we can do about that through both the legal system and otherwise. Now, this is something that we're all familiar with, you know, your standard error page that comes up when you're trying to access, you know, whatever it is you're trying to get on the web and you can't get it. Now, for most of us, we're lucky enough that usually the cause is fairly benign. The server is down or whatever, someone hit the wrong button at, you know, CNN and, you know, their site goes down. But in many places, the cause is not so benign. This is an image of a warning that you might get in South Korea, which has a fairly robust internet filtering system. This is one from Bahrain explaining that that what you're trying to access is considered illegal content. And these little cartoons were dreamed up by an internet service provider in China, presumably with the hope that if you were looking at something cute enough, you wouldn't care anymore that the content you were trying to reach was blocked. So the challenge for us is that if you want to do anything about censorship, if you even want to talk about what's going on, you need to know what is actually going on. And unlike you know, when you ship a package with FedEx, FedEx is a centralized system and can tell you you know, where your package is. The internet is not centralized in that way, which has both very good and very bad pieces to it. The, you know, Wendy was talking, you know, Tor benefits from the internet not being centralized, but from the standpoint of trying to understand what's going on, there's no FedEx-like system that can tell you what's going on the internet in terms of your packets instead of your packages. And so that's what we're trying to provide through the Herdict project. Herdict is a portmanteau of Verdict of the Herd, and what we do is we're trying to crowdsource the question of what is accessible on the web in real time at any given moment. And the way we collect this data is through many different sources. This is an image right off of the Herdict.org homepage where people can report sites directly through through a box on the homepage. We have a browser add-on for Chrome, Firefox, and Internet Explorer that you can, if you reach a site that you can't get to, you can click the little button and file a report. We have what we call the Herdict Reporter, which is sort of the web accessibility version of amihotornot.com, if any of you remember that, where it loads a page and then you click the button saying accessible or inaccessible, and when you click that, it will load the very next page in our queue. And we also accept reports through Twitter, at Herdict Report on Twitter. And so what do we do with all of this data? Well, we aggregate it, and whereas one report might not tell us very much, after all, you know, maybe someone's, you know, ISP is on the fritz and there's no, you know, generalized outage in a particular country or location, but maybe 5 inaccessible reports or 10 or 20 begin to tell us something. And so we can sort that, and it's all of our data is publicly available and entirely sortable through the site. Since July 2009, when the project started, we've received over 100,000 inaccessible reports. In fact, this weekend was when we cracked the 100,000 mark, and over 140,000 accessible reports, which we consider pretty good, given that the site is still very much in beta, and that we haven't been actively promoting it. So, in practice, what does this mean? As many of you may be aware, on May 20th, for 8 hours, Pakistan blocked Twitter. And what we saw on Herdict was this. Prior to May 20th, this is a chart of just reports from Pakistan on Twitter for about 30 days. And what you see is there was nothing interesting going on with Twitter, and then all of a sudden you hit the 8-hour period on May 20th, and we got 60 reports, several hundred visitors from Pakistan over that period, and then as soon as the block was lifted, we got a few accessible reports, and then things returned to normal. So in order to talk about the legal aspect to all of this, I want to talk for a moment about beer. I'm sure that all of you are familiar with Richard Stallman's famous quote about free as in free speech, not as in free beer. Well, I want to talk both about alcohol for a minute and about freedom. And what we have here is a chart that shows different countries' drinking ages. And as you can see, the U.S. And India and several other countries are in red. That's 21 years. All the blue are 18. The green are 17, I believe. And then the black are where alcohol isn't allowed to be consumed at all. And, you know, this is generally something that we legally speaking, accept countries' rights to determine what their citizens can and cannot imbibe as a drink. And for better or worse, this same principle tends to apply to content on the internet. In the United States, the government has determined that people should not be able to access child pornography. Several years ago in France went after Yahoo Auctions, which was an eBay-like site, for providing access to Nazi paraphernalia, because they have very strong laws in France about accessing or being able to receive Holocaust-related artifacts. And so they succeeded in a case against the auction site of forcing them to remove those items for anyone visiting from the country. And then, of course, we have China, which believes that rumors, as they call them, people should not be able to access. And so they have tons of regulations, particularly over the past several weeks. They've been cracking down very hard on Sina Weibo, which is the Chinese equivalent of Twitter. And they've been instituting a variety of measures, including real name registration, so that individuals can only tweet using their actual identity. And so from a legal standpoint, from a purely legal standpoint, it's a bit of a challenge when each country can assert that there's particular content that they believe is harmful to their citizens. That's not to say that there aren't any legal steps that can be taken. Just a few months ago, in October of 2011, the U.S. filed what's called an inquiry with the WTO about the effect that Chinese censorship was having on U.S. businesses. And this inquiry is viewed as the first stage to possibly it filing a challenge with the WTO, saying that this censorship is discriminating against U.S. companies. So that's certainly one potential legal avenue, although that may, in the end, only end up benefiting big companies that are trying to do business in China, not necessarily, journalism or other things that are important to free speech on the internet. So the approach that we're really taking with Herdict is to try to raise awareness about what's going on by collecting data, and this may end up being perhaps, even though it's not a legal and I say that not to mean that it is illegal, but to mean that it is not using the judicial system to try to affect change. But you know, this kind of raising awareness has proven to be successful in the past on some issues. Certainly we all know the issues about Nike and its relationship with child labor, in which there's been a lot of scrutiny just over the past few months. There was similar scrutiny brought against Apple and their conditions in their Foxconn factories, and that's prompted several changes. And there are really a lot of organizations out there. Herdict is just one that's really trying to raise awareness about when people are trying to access content and are unable to do so. Herdict is just one approach. And I'm happy to talk more in the Q&A about what we're doing and any other issues with censorship and filtering.
Great. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Yeah. Andy, I'd just like to break in here to thank all four of our participants for terrific talks. We are going to, so I'm going to break the pattern.
Do it.
Quick little round of applause. Yeah.
Why don't you start?
Sure. Yeah. I'm here basically to kick off the conversation, and it's realizing that here at the end of the day, we're actually, through these panelists, at a great point to sort of talk about some of the bigger themes we've seen during the day. And I guess one of the things I'd like to call attention to first is the fact that throughout the day we've been hearing a number of, shall we say, gloomy comments about the interaction of law and technology and, you know, the state of civil rights and the state of privacy and these kinds of issues with respect to how they're being treated by the United States government, how they're being treated by the governments nationwide. A couple of points I wanted to call out that we've heard a couple of times. We heard the ACLU of Massachusetts earlier today urge technologists not to store unnecessary data. Hannah, you said something very similar in your talk. Wendy, you called attention to the fact that the U.S. government, if it wants access to data, doesn't need, has ways to get it without necessarily going through, without necessarily talking to doctors, journalists, people who might have some sort of a legal privilege. That kind of comment we have heard, from officials at the NSA as they've, spoken to, Lucy Dalglish at the Reporters Committee for Freedom of the Press, same kind of thought. And a comment which has been common to all four talks is that really your rights online are going to be dependent on interactions with other private parties operating online, whether, Mike, it's in connection with different people, with different players in the space sharing information, whether it's a news API and somebody who's using the API, Annie, whether it's somebody, whether it's a private party that's holding your data, somebody, Wendy, somebody who's an ISP who's keeping your identity private, and, Ryan, whether or not, somebody's succumbing to government pressure and shutting down that kind of conversation, which sort of leads to the big question, which is, are legal rights in this space entirely dependent on technology? Can you, does a legal right have any force if it isn't backed up by some sort of technological solution or technological measure to try to, to try to avoid those who would abuse that right? And let that sink in, but would anybody like to? Okay.
Let me try.
Okay.
I think you're right to the extent that a lot of
like when we talk about established judicial authority, so I use the example of the Stored Communications Act, or case law, for example, has taken a very technologically specific point of view in the sense that courts, generally speaking, even taking outside of the technology realm, have always tried to narrow their decisions to kind of really fit the facts at hand. And what's happened is courts have made decisions based on whatever specific technology they're addressing at that particular moment in time, which makes some sense. But then the problem becomes that the law is built upon prior precedents, especially case law. And so what happens is, and I kind of alluded to this when talking about the third party doctrine, what could arguably have made sense when dealing with bank records in the 1970s is simply not applicable anymore. And the law is very slow to catch up to that. And so I think that people in this space, whether they're technologists or they're in the legal system, have to do a better job of educating courts as to the broader implications in the future of what that specific decision means. And I think courts are starting to very slowly get that. I mentioned Justice Sotomayor's opinion in United States versus Jones. So that's the GPS case that the Supreme Court decided earlier this year. And she has a concurring opinion where, kind of out of the blue, she says, we need to re-examine this idea that people lose their privacy rights when they turn information over to third parties. And what she says, and to quote her, is that this approach is ill-suited when dealing with the realities of technology in the 21st century. So, I mean, with the hope of sounding optimistic, I think there is a, you know, this is one example of, I think, courts starting to become a little bit more thoughtful. You can also see that approach in other cases that have dealt with the third-party doctrine and, like, cell phone location tracking records, like that hopefully, you know, our efforts have been successful in at least getting courts to think about things beyond the confines of the specific case at hand and think about the broader future implication.
Yeah, I think that there's a constant trade-off between law and technology and as to which will govern a particular set of actions. So if it's something that the technology enables us to keep entirely private so we never have to go to the courts, then the technology may take precedence. If the identities were sort of posted along with the postings to message boards, nobody would be bringing a case to the courts. And we wouldn't see it there. If the identities were totally shielded and there were no way, even by going through the courts, to get access to them, then the technology would give rights back to individuals. And in between, when there are places that you need to call upon the law to try to vindicate rights or to try to demand extra considerations, then we see fights in the courts, fights being settled through contract rather than tech. And I don't think we can say either one of them is going to win out long term. I expect us to constantly see tensions between them.
I guess I sort of see technology and the law sort of as, you know, headwinds that can either be, you know, pushing you in the right direction or pushing you in the wrong direction. And I think both either technology or law can be in that position. So you can have laws, you know, like they have in China with regards to the microblogging that right now are very consumer friendly if you're concerned about anonymity and free speech. Even though the technology itself of microblogging has been viewed quite positively in China, but in the same way, you know, you can have technologies that are very unfriendly and helpful for anonymity, even in a situation where there's good law. So I guess, you know, ideally you'd want a situation where both the law and the technology are helping you out, and if either one or, God forbid, both are against you, then you're really in trouble.
Mike, do you?
Yeah, I guess the way that I see this intersection in sort of the right that I was talking about, which is this public right to hear, which I acknowledge is sort of a very it's very unpopular right, I think, in an American context. I think there's sort of a right of expression is the one that's paramount. But I think there's a thread that you can see throughout various policy decisions and court decisions around sort of technologies of attention, and whether that's sort of, you know, managing spectrum, or whether that was, you know, the demise of the fairness doctrine in sort of the aftermath of, you know, cable industry, and sort of, I think a lot of times along the way, there have been policy comments and court decisions that have given interpretations about what various technologies are actually doing in terms of attention management. So it's very, it's difficult to argue for a public right to hear unless side by side with that, you're talking about what is the likelihood of hearing something, or what is the chance that you are going to attend to a particular idea, or what does the landscape look like that's going to get your attention at any given point along the way. So I see there's a great, Frederick Schauer is a sort of First Amendment scholar in this, said we have to be careful not to institutionally compress the press or the First Amendment, not to say that we think that the press is all one thing. And so his recommendation is actually use the technologies as a point of differentiation, really have courts actually get really nitty-gritty about what kind of attention different technologies are affording. So I think that's a great moment of attending to the technology in a really specific way.
Thank you. Do we have any questions from the floor? I'm happy to go on asking questions, but I want to make sure that you all have the chance to share your thoughts. David.
Hey, it's nice to be optimistic, but only one justice of nine signed on to an opinion that said maybe there's a problem with the third-party doctrine, so I don't know if I can quite share your optimism.
Well, I certainly can appreciate that. I think the fact that we had one justice out of nine, to me, is a sign of optimism, because for many years, I would have made a guess that we would have had zero. So I guess I'm an uber optimist. But I think what's important is that the conversation started. And I said it was kind of out of the blue, because Jones is not a third party doctrine case at all, in fact. It's a case about whether you have a privacy right in movements you show to the public. And the Supreme Court didn't even decide the case on that ground. They decided it on trespass, right? Which is, and given the way technology is already antiquated as a form of technology. So I think Justice Sotomayor has kickstarted the conversation. And in the cases that have come out, and there aren't a lot of them, but in the cases that have come out in the 6 months since the Supreme Court decided Jones, we're seeing litigants make the argument. So there was a cell site tracking case out of Maryland where the parties raised the point, and the judge said, look, this is still the law. The third party doctrine is still the law, so I'm going to follow it. Your argument's interesting. But I think what's important is people start to rely and build upon that point, and it starts to get raised more frequently, we're going to start to see an intelligent conversation about it. And again, because the law moves like a, you know, yes, I was thinking a glacier. I couldn't think of what you're saying. Because the law moves slowly, it may not be resolved, or the court may never get to it for a while, but at least the conversation is piqued litigants' interest and piqued litigators' interest, and they're raising the point. And to me, if I can take that little measure of solace in it, I will.
Anybody else? Alrighty, I have a question, and this is going to be less grand than the last one, but I'll toss it out there. Wendy, I did want to thank you for the plug for the Citizen Media Law Project, which is the project that Andy and I work at. And I wanted to raise a question with you, which comes out of some of the work we've been doing lately and some of the issues we've been seeing arising relating to anonymity. And I'd appreciate the thoughts of the panel as well. You're talking about the right of anonymity. You talked about the McIntyre case, and obviously the McIntyre case involved a form of political speech, perhaps in a smaller context, but nevertheless, you know, urging public participation. The major issues, I mean, the vast amount of anonymous speech that we see online these days is, I would think it's fair to say, is usually of a less elevated nature. And, you know, we've been seeing pressure lately in certain kinds of cases, defamation cases in particularly, on the application of First Amendment and constitutional rights when you have a private party speaking on matters of private concern, saying that, you know, the First Amendment protections which have developed over time don't necessarily apply there. Do you think we're going to start to see this similar pushback on the First Amendment right to speak anonymously, that where you're not talking about political speech, where it's not so clear that you can invoke Publius and, you know, the federal farmer, that we'll see courts resisting the argument about the right to speak anonymously?
Well, I think I'm going to take your question in two directions. One is, will we even get to the courts with those questions? Because so much of our online speech is now in sort of these private environments where it's subject to real name policies on Facebook or Google Plus, and we're opting in, or so we're told, to these environments where we agree to be identified by name, and it doesn't cut down on the nastiness of some of those environments, I don't think, but it does cut down on the opportunities to have debate that's not identified with the offline persona. So that's sort of one thing. We need to, I think, preserve the architectural space and the fora for these free, unidentified discussions. And then a lot depends for courts on the kinds of cases that come before them. So it's the reason that EFF and ACLU are always out, public knowledge, always out looking for the right plaintiffs who are bringing cases that make this the point about the importance of speech. Now, it's not always sympathetic plaintiffs. A whole lot of First Amendment cases have the Ku Klux Klan demanding their right to assemble wearing masks and their right to spew hateful speech as they parade through the towns where none of the residents want to see them, and yet the courts recognized those as expressing First Amendment value and carrying a message, even if it was not a message that that most citizens wanted to hear. So I think as long as we are finding cases that have a core of something that's contributing to dialogue, it doesn't need to be a lofty political message. It can be a hateful message. As if it's something that's in that marketplace of ideas that will eventually help us as citizens to resolve the deeper questions.
So I'm going to kind of throw more kind of almost a fun question at you guys. If there's one thing we can sort of get from all of this today, it's that the internet's decentralization in its operation lives through everything that it touches, including policy. All of the different players in the space, from the website to the user to the intermediaries between, to the ISPs, to the governments in the countries that are using, which is every country now, have an ability to influence, but none can control. Nor do I think we would want to have a fundamental authority, a final authority as to a lot of these matters. I mean, ICANN is kind of the closest thing we get in some areas, and even that has many critics and many concerns. But pretend you're emperor for a day. What is the one change that you would make to law or policy to further your goals of civil rights? And what is the one change to technology or technological architecture that you would make to further those rights? And anyone who wants to start.
Fun question, but not a simple one.
No, I didn't say it was simple. I said it'd be fun.
Let's see. A change I would make to law would be dramatically reduce the terms of copyright and the presumptions that go along with it. I think we're in danger of seeing sort of copyright brought to distort internet architecture as copyright holders come forth and say, we have these government-granted rights to a term of life plus 70 years and attaching by default to anything that's creative expression fixed in a tangible medium, and therefore we should be able to take down domain names or force content hosts to take down material or force the takedown of video, and they try to insinuate their way into the very architecture of the net, forcing educational institutions to implement peer-to-peer blocking and traffic shaping and management software. So I think that's a legal change that I'd like to see.
Technology change?
I can.
Oh, you want to do all our legal changes first? So I'm going to be asking for both from each of you.
That's good. I'll let somebody else go while I continue thinking.
Well, I was going to offer a technology change.
By all means. I'm keeping a tally of who's done what so far.
Well, I think that, you know, when you think about both censorship and really its flip side of the coin, which is surveillance, you know, you have this problem that in, you know, like I guess we saw with Egypt, you know, their step was to shut off the internet, but in Syria, sort of learning from that, they actually opened up a bunch of services that they hadn't previously allowed people to use, with the express intent of getting people to use those services so they could then track exactly what they were doing, monitor them, arrest them, you know, break up protests. And so from a technology standpoint, I think, you know, there are so many things that web browsers, which is primarily how people interact through, you know, with the rest of the internet, could be doing to ensure greater security for the people using them that they are not doing. You know, something as simple as, you know, HTTPS, you know, for every single connection, you know, seems like such an obvious thing that is not being done. You know, so much of the content that people are sending out to the internet are sent entirely in the clear, and that exposes a great many people to potential danger. And in addition, you know, they have things like incognito mode, which make people, because of poor labeling, think that they're getting, you know, some level of protection that they are not actually getting. You know, incognito mode really only helps you if you, like, leave your computer somewhere and someone tries to see what your browsing history was. But it does absolutely nothing to protect you if the Syrian government is reading your emails. So I think that, you know, as a technological change, I think web browsers really need to step up in what they're doing so that, you know, we shouldn't have to rely on people knowing what Tor is and then downloading it just to be able to get some basic level of protection.
Mike?
I guess it's more sort of a policy one, but I think greater support or encouragement for news organizations to become 501c3s or to experiment with that as an organizational form. I know there's a lot of people who are working on those things, but I think that would actually add some sort of diversity to the institutional space that news organizations are currently working in, and I think that there's a sort of a paucity of experimenting with different types of revenue streams or different types of tax code characters that news organizations could assume, because I think that it doesn't have to be sort of the kind of overwhelming set of privately owned media actors that we tend to rely upon right now.
Great. So totally divorced from the internet world specifically, but allowing the people that are doing stuff on the internet to have the tax treatment and revenue structures they need to be nonprofits, to be collaboratives or corporations or being whatever sort of business model makes sense, so that they thrive. That's great. Annie?
So, you know, the legal change I'd like to see is a reexamination of what Justice Marshall once called this problem that secrecy is considered a prerequisite for privacy. It's only in the tech sphere it feels like that is a kind of implicit understanding with how the law applies. So if I turn over my location to AT&T so they can properly route my cell phone call, that doesn't mean I authorize AT&T to turn over that information to everybody else who wants it, in other words, the government, right? But the problem is you get AT&T tells you we're gonna do this and you really have no choice to do this unless, or you can go find another company, but then all the other companies do it, and that's a real problem. And in other areas of the law, there's an understanding that secrecy is not a prerequisite to privacy, or the idea like, you know, the law recognizes that you have a privilege in communications you make with your spouse, for example, and the idea that, you know, you intend to keep that conversation private. Now you have to make, you know, if you go, you know, if I'm yelling in a crowded room to my wife, you know, I've lost that privacy right. But if I'm talking in the comfort of my house to my wife and I haven't said, you know, okay, I'm gonna draw the blinds and I'm gonna close the door and we're gonna whisper to each other so that we can maintain our privacy. You know, the law doesn't recognize that. It takes a more nuanced approach about it, but it doesn't do that with technology. And I think that's a fundamental flaw, particularly as people are giving more and more information about themselves over to companies like Facebook or Google or whatever. So that's the legal change I'd like to see.
So like doctor patient, like attorney client, like spouse, user OSP.
Sure, you know, now I understand, you know, the relationship I have with Facebook is not the same as the relationship I have with my wife, but I think the law evolved to understand that it wasn't all or nothing in those types of relationships. And it needs to evolve into a place where it's not all or nothing with the technology company that we turn over communication and content and information over to. And there's a space where we can carve out a appropriate balance where the government can investigate crime and get its hands on information that it needs, but in a way that takes into account privacy. And traditionally, that's always been with a search warrant requirement. But we're seeing the loss of that that constitutional protection in the online world, and I think that's where we need to see the change.
Great.
And Andy, if I can jump in, just
yes, by all means.
Close to time. There are a couple of things I just want to finish up with, let you have your say too. But the first thing I wanted to say is thank you again to our panel. Thank you to Andy for moderation and your incredibly timely segue summaries between the presentations. They ended just as the next presentation was coming up. Also wanted to thank Kit Walsh for organizing all of today's panels in this room.
Give Kit a great big round of applause because he really was the architect behind this whole days long presentation. So.
And I also just wanted to call one more event this evening to your attention if you're interested. At 6 o'clock at the Boston Public Library, John Palfrey, who's faculty director of the Berkman Center for Internet Society, with whom many of us are affiliated up here, is going to be presenting on his book, Interop, the Promise and Perils of Highly Interconnected Systems, which promises to be an excellent talk, and he is an excellent speaker. That's at Boston Public Library just down the street, so if that's of interest, please go see it.
Great. I do want to throw it to the room one more time. I saw one tweet that was concerned that we're being a little too US-centric that I hope was clarified by some of the later presentations. But if you guys have any other questions or comments, this would be a good time to raise them. No. Okay. Well, I guess then we'll leave it at that. So thank you guys again. Let me just echo what Jeff said. Thank you guys very much. This was really great to have so many different perspectives on some similar issues, and it was wonderful to have you guys here. So thank you guys so much.
Thank you all for coming.
Thank you.